Welcome to The Perspectivalist. Our agenda is to offer a perspective of the world that allows you to think more clearly as a Christian. We want the normativity of the scriptures to be the starting point of everything we do. So thanks for joining the conversation. This is the last episode of season 4, episode 20. I'm your host, Yuri Brito. And we look forward to a new season starting next week with new intro, outro music produced by Mr. George Reed and a host of interviews, monologues, and an overview of political and theological content. It's my privilege this morning to introduce for the first time to my audience, Mr. David Bahnsen, whose resume is replete with accomplishments as a political, economic commentator and a host of television networks, author of several books, husband and father, and as I have just noticed, also a connoisseur of Chinese food. So welcome, David.
Well, you got the important things all covered there. Yes, sir. Good to be with you, Pastor.
Yeah, great to be with you again. Great to see you one more time. David's new book entitled Full Time Work and the Meaning of Life will be out in a few days. And I wanted to bring attention to my listeners about this great new book that I've been able to work my way through. And David, I want to begin by asking what you see as the central thesis of work according to modern evangelicalism. In other words, what's the faulty thesis that you are fighting in this book?
I think that there are three different theses. I guess the word would be theses. And they are not as much faulty as they are incomplete. And the first one is the most faulty or most incomplete, which is that work is a mere means to an end. That work has value to the extent that it enables us to provide for ourselves, but that it's basically a part of the curse, and that we are cursed with having to work in order to make ends meet. And I think that that is a very long-held view in many circles, and unfortunately in certain Christian ones as well. But we've elevated past that in a lot of evangelicalism and sort of graduated. And I think level two is where one says, no, not only can you make a living through work, but you can also then obtain the means to do kingdom work. Mm-hmm. So there's an immediate dualism that's evident, but it is utilitarian. Let's do work so we can tithe to your church, so we can fund Christian ministries, other things where the real kingdom work is being done. And then the graduation from that is, no, not only can you make a living and not only can you support ministry, but work is also important because you might earn reputation, you might earn regard, you might gain an ability from your performance in the workforce to witness, you might gain influence. So it is a sort of elevated version of level two, where the work is acknowledged as a springboard to some sort of gravitas, yet the focus is still on what can be done with that, as opposed to the work itself. And where my view comes in, what I consider to be the Kuyperian view, and certainly the biblical one, is that all three of those miss out on the inherent value of the work itself.
Okay, very good. Let me follow up a little bit on that here. I've been read quite a bit of the philosopher Joseph Pieper on leisure. And I'm wondering, as you are thinking through this issue here and elaborating the book, there's always this bifurcation I see in a lot of writing on work, as you've referenced, bifurcation between work and leisure. Are you arguing that we should be careful of that distinction, that it really doesn't exist? Or is your concern to place those two things, work and leisure, in their proper perspective and order?
Yeah, I have a whole chapter in the book where I suggest that the most common nomenclature, I wish I heard the word leisure more. I think it's an interesting word that could be made in overlap with the biblical word of rest. But what we most commonly hear today is work-life balance. And the presupposition in the very vocabulary is that your work and your life are two separate things that need to be balanced. And some people might disagree about the asset allocation. What is the pie chart supposed to be? But either way, using that language is a nod to the idea that work is not part of our life. It's separate from our life. Therefore, work is something we do to support our life. And in our life is our leisure, our recreation, our family, our hobbies, those things that we really care about, with work being this sort of separated entity. And what I do in the book and argue passionately, because it's actually something that really animates me, is that work is part of our life, and therefore to separate the two as some form of dichotomy is fundamentally flawed, but that there is a scriptural distinction found in the creation account called the work-rest paradigm. Of course, God worked 6 days and rested one. Then he took that model and specifically told us to replicate it. So if we are wanting to fight about some form of asset allocation between work and rest, I already have a pretty good place to start in the 6-to-1, since God did it and told us to do it. But I still don't believe that work rest is the same as work versus life. And I suspect that the work rest paradigm is closer to capturing leisure in the right biblical context.
Okay, that's an interesting point you raised, because I think as I prepare my agenda, there is an intense leisurely dimension to my work. I find rest, I find fulfillment, fruitfulness. And that is in other words, work and rest seem to come together when we bring these concepts, but when we bifurcate them, we expect work to be monotonous and leisure to be fruitful and filled with diversity. Any thoughts on that?
Well, I agree that for those of us who love our work, this does get a little trickier. I think that it's easier to think of work rest, rest being a concept that God gave us. He commanded us to do it, but did it for our benefit. You know, the Sabbath was made for us, according to the scriptures. And I think that it's easier to think about it when one is in a physical labor, that they're exhausted from the factory or the farm or the fields. And for those of us who love our work and maybe are students of the market or students of theology or students, you know, it's difficult, because I know myself, when I take a vacation, I'm generally bringing books to read that are very related to my work. Yeah. But I would say, as a best practice, I don't know how normative I'd want to be on this, that there is, I think, a tremendous benefit to work and rest in a context of separation, much like when we lay our heads down at night and we are quite literally resting physically to the point of being in a form of sleep, that at that point we are taking that break and separation from our vocation. But no, I think that there's some gray area in it. And yet, I also believe that there's a real blessing to getting the proper rest that we need. However, I do not think most people suffer from getting from working too much. I think that the primary emphasis that we ought to have now is on cautioning people against wanting to lean too much into a sort of lifestyle of rest or leisure, and that is by far the more predominant issue that the church has to deal with.
Yeah, I agree, and I wonder if you could sort of encapsulate this idea as you're communicating from a biblical perspective, and then respond to what I'm about to say here, and that is that it seems to me that there is a difference in how you view a host of things related to labor, and it seems that a lot of evangelical interpretation of this issue views work from the lens of Genesis 3 instead of Genesis 1. How do you respond to that?
Well, it was an entire chapter in the book that forced me to do something I don't do a whole lot, which was try to do a little exegesis. Mm-hmm. And the reason I don't do it a lot is because I'm a a congregant at church, not a preacher at church. And so I generally like to benefit from others' exegesis and not have to try to do it myself. But this exegesis is sorely lacking in today's church. Genesis 3 is not instituting work. Genesis 1 instituted work, it modeled work, and in fact, it formed the basis of the creation of mankind around work. That God made us to be, first of all, as image bearers of him, to be workers, producers, cultivators, stewards of not only the garden, but indeed the whole earth, and carry with that a certain dominion. These are all either verbs or nouns that come back to some form of activity, that come back to some form of productive work and engagement. Ultimately, the theological conclusion as you go deeper into Genesis, which, by the way, is after Genesis 3, is the formation of a civilization. Mm-hmm. Mankind was asked to build a civilization here on earth. And I wholeheartedly believe in the doctrine of the fall. So therefore, out of the doctrine of creation is where work was instituted. And then our beliefs about a whole lot of things get complicated by the fall. But then our hope comes after the fall with the doctrine of redemption. And I think that work is something that existed in creation, was altered in the fall with a certain specificity, and yet is very much a part of our redemptive efforts.
Okay. When we begin to talk about work, we begin to talk about technological innovations, there's always a tendency among our elite experts to make work more efficient. We're experiencing, of course, as you know better than anyone else, a technological revolution aimed at decreasing the workload, David, and then increasing our pleasures, our leisure, whatever. And the argument among many is that we're going to be entering into an age of less human ingenuity because the creative force is going to come through robotic hands or whatever. What is your word for those who seem enthused about the role of big technology interfering with human labor? They're excited, and they are, you know, and they're making a dissertation out of this excitement.
Well, I think some of the people that are excited for technology to disintermediate the intensity of work need are not themselves the creators or designers of the new technology. They're the beneficiaries of it who are talking their own book, so to speak. In other words, they are aspirationally hoping they can become more lazy as a result of greater technology. What's interesting is that a lot of the big purveyors of new tech over the last 50 years are some of the biggest workaholics I've ever seen because they are either through common grace or in some cases, actually saved, are themselves hopelessly entrepreneurial. It's mm-hmm. in their DNA. And there is no signs of some of those people using the advancements of technology to work less, but most certainly using them to enhance quality of life or advance some particular aim, some of which I would argue are not constructive in society, but a good portion of which have entirely changed the world for the better. Now, this is a really important question because I think Ecclesiastes is very important here about there being nothing new under the sun. Whether from artificial intelligence or the cloud or digital computing or any number of things that are all just kind of decade by decade, 10 years apart from one another, all we're talking about over the last 50 years is some form of digital computing that's a byproduct of the microprocessor. And if you want to really take it back before that, the Industrial Revolution was a series of technological advancements. And if you want to go back to ancient days, the creation of the wheel and how we learned how to start fire were really the same thing. It's just simply far more impressive and fast now. The technology is faster. Mm-hmm. But I think that technology is not an end. It is a means to an end. And technology, therefore, like so many other things in the earthly realm, can be used for good or can be used for bad. And to the extent that there is a whole lot of people that want to use technology to work less, I think that they are misguided. But market forces embedded in God's creative intentions will not allow people to flourish by using technology solely as a means to work less. Now, there are certain tasks that can get done quicker and easier, and that frees us up for more freedom, more convenience, and enhanced quality of life. I do not bemoan that. But when we talk about it being an existential objective to simply have more dormancy, more idleness, then I push back immensely, not because I don't recognize that some may want that, but because I do not believe that to be a good end. I believe it to be contrary to what God created us for.
Great. We're speaking with David Bond. So, David, final question. I'm a pastor here in Pensacola, Florida, and I have a lot of young men in my growing congregation entering into the workforce. As one who has taught high schoolers and has been very much engaged in the process of discipleship in the workforce, what wisdom would you give the young men in my congregation and others who are listening now as they're entering the workforce?
Well, and I take from the implication of the question, you're referring to an age group of people just starting in their careers, so presumably maybe young 20s, sometimes mid-20s, post-college, things of that nature. And it's fascinating to me, Pastor, how much of this is generational. That there's a certain lesson I care about a lot that is applicable to middle-aged men, 50s, 60s. There's a different lesson for those that might be in the middle of a career, but not near the end of it, and maybe, let's say, in their late 30s or something. But that lesson to younger men starting off, in a lot of ways, I think it's a generic lesson that I want to apply a specifically Christian context to. There is nothing owed to us. The entitlement that many enter the workforce with today, I think, is very counterproductive. Going in with a grit and a resilience that will overcome adversity and not believe that we are entitled something is an important lesson, even for people of faith, because our culture has been so prosperous, because we have benefited so much from the work of people who've come before us, that it's tempting to believe we can now have things much easier than we're really intended to have them. So I think a grit and a tenacity not only brings gratitude for blessings that do come and overcomes some of the counterproductive behaviors and attitudes that I'm referring to, but I also believe it becomes a character trait that parlays into more effectiveness in the workforce, more sacrifice, more care for others, more humility, more maturity and poise. And so just starting off with an expectation that is unrealistic is very dangerous and toxic. And starting off with, you know, that kind of grit and resilience, I think springboards into a far more opportunistic position as one enters the workforce. There's so many different elements to this. You know, the challenges people have, a lot, I don't agree with any Christian approach to talking about advice for work that is intentionally divorced from advice about money, family, practical considerations. That notion we hear of just chase your dreams and let everything come together, I think is very anti-biblical. And so there are economic realities that we want to consider. And at the same time, the gratitude I have for a market economy that does allow a greater possibility of mirroring our passions to our skills than the world has ever had, the world has ever seen. We are not slaves to a forced career path very often. There's a lot of dynamism available to young people entering the workforce. We should be grateful for that. And then we need to be very open, humble, and industrious. And doors will open, and God will bless the fruits of those labors.
Oh, very good. David Bondson is the author of forthcoming book, Full Time Work and the Meaning of Life. David, an absolute privilege to have you at the Perspectivalist. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, Pastor.